From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowen, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, how to watch baseball like a pro. We'll talk with sports commentator and former major leaguer Tim McCarver. He'll give us some tips on the best way to make sense of the game's underlying strategies. Also, we'll talk with Jamie Lee Curtis, who stars in the new movie Halloween H2O. It's the sequel to the horror classic Halloween, the film which launched Curtis's career. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us the strange story of singer Joe Tex, and linguist Jeff Numberg tells us about the new cult of knowledge that's flourishing in business and academic circles. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Clinton has condemned today's bombings at U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, calling them inhuman terrorist attacks. And he says the United States will use all means to find those responsible. Hundreds were injured in the blast and dozens killed. Nina Gulb of the International Red Cross is helping to treat victims of the blast in Nairobi.
We have at least 400 wounded. There will be more, we are sure, as the rubble around the building is cleared up. The Kenyan Red Cross have set up a first aid center some hundreds of meters from the bomb blast.
A State Department official has confirmed that at least four Americans were among those killed in the Nairobi bombing. So far, no American deaths are reported at a similar blast in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Jim Owens was in the U.S. Embassy when that bomb went off.
There were some people that I saw that were very badly injured. I helped one woman down the stairways whose half of her nose was missing. She was bleeding profusely, but she was really quite calm and very deliberate in her motions, so I think she's going to be okay. The people in the front of the building, I would have to say, probably didn't stand a chance.
The U.S. is rushing medical supplies to both countries, and security measures have been tightened at American embassies throughout Africa. The central Chinese city of Wuhan is on high alert with the new crest of the Yangtze River approaching. The 3,900-mile-long river is at record levels, and today it crested in Shasha, about 150 miles upstream from Wuhan. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead has more from Shasha.
The morning started in Shasha with a convoy of hundreds of trucks loaded with thousands of soldiers on their way to evacuate people from areas where dikes might have to be destroyed to prevent further damage downstream. Local officials say some 100,000 people have already been evacuated, and six dikes have now been destroyed. Officials say they reserve the option to blow up more dikes if the racing river grows unmanageable, but so far, they say, it's not necessary. Days of relatively dry weather have kept the Yangtze crest stable enough that residents of Shasha were today frolicking in waist-deep water on a flooded street within view of the river. Some said they were a little nervous with the water edging higher, but most expressed confidence that the government will do whatever necessary to keep their city safe. Mary Kay Magstead, NPR News, Shasha, China.
President Clinton signed the Workforce Investment Act of 1998 at a Rose Garden ceremony today, his second such event in 2 days. The measure is a job training effort, which has been described as a GI Bill for workers. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 97.5 points at 86.75. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up about 32 points. This is NPR News in Washington. In NPR's business updates, Southern New England Telecommunications has reached a tentative contract agreement with a union representing its operators, line workers, and other employees. A Communications Worker of America shop steward confirmed the agreement just moments ago. The company had been bracing for a weekend walkout. The current 3-year contract expires on Sunday. The Labor Department is out with its latest look at the nation's job picture. The July unemployment report showed steady growth and low inflation. And NPR's Jack Speer reports it seems to be giving the stock market a much-needed boost at the week's end.
The news that the nation's unemployment rate held steady last month at 4.5% is being well-received by Wall Street. Labor Department reported the economy generated 66,000 jobs in July, the slowest growth in more than 2 years. That was largely blamed on the now settled strike at General Motors. Meanwhile, concerns a tight labor market might send wages soaring were not evident in the numbers. It showed only a 0.2% rise in wages last month. Semiconductor stocks are up for the third day in a row amid some optimism. A sales downturn may be over. Also rising today, stock in computer company Compaq. That's after Goldman Sachs upped its rating for the company. Stock in CBS is higher today. Following a report by Business Week, the company could be acquired or put some of its units up for sale. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, the government says wholesale sales rose 0.3% in June, and that was the biggest gain in 3 months. The Commerce Department also says that wholesale inventories inched up by 0.1%. And on Wall Street, the Dow Industrial is up 97 points at this hour. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tim McCarver knows baseball from the inside and out. From 1959 to 1980, he was a major league catcher playing for the St. Louis Cardinals, the Philadelphia Phillies, the Montreal Expos, and the Boston Red Sox. During those 21 years, he distinguished himself on the field and ended his career with a .271 lifetime batting average. Not long after he retired from baseball, McCarver was hired by the Mets as a member of their broadcast team. Now you can catch him doing analysis for the Game of the Week, the All-Star Game, and Fox Television. As an announcer, McCarver is known for his candor, his ability to turn a clever phrase, and his deep understanding of the physics and psychology of the game. He also writes about baseball, and earlier this year came out with a book, Baseball for Brain Surgeons and Other Fans. I asked Tim McCarver what it was like to go from playing to talking about the game.
It's a different ball game from upstairs. Not only do you have nothing to do with the game or the outcome of the game, you see the game differently. Often the dugouts of Major League Baseball fields are the worst places to view a baseball game when you're looking to see if an outfielder is playing straight away, if an outfielder is shading a hitter to pull, or if he's shading him the other way. Sometimes your focus is confusing when you look at it from the dugout. When you look at it from upstairs, the view of the game is different. You see more of an overall a team concept.
Now, as a broadcaster, you work standing up. Are you just too antsy, too excited to sit in a chair during a game?
I squatted for 21 years.
So you're happy to stand
and
up.
And so I'm finally standing up in life. I caught from the time I was 10 years old. I turned professional when I was 17 out of high school. And then I caught professionally for 21 years. So that's 28 years or 29 years on your haunches. And I was a fast runner when I broke in. I was not a fast runner when I retired because the ordeal and the grueling position of catching takes its toll primarily on the ankles and the knees, and you don't really have a chance to stretch your legs out as much as you would like to. But I did a lot of stretching the last 5 years of my career, but it's still a very, very difficult position. And that, I think, is one of the reasons that I stand up when I broadcast.
Well, you talk about the importance as a catcher of when a runner's coming home of standing on home plate.
Mm-hmm. And blocking the plate.
Right.
I see a diminishing number of catchers blocking home plate. The last catcher that was terrific at doing so was Mike Socia of the Los Angeles Dodgers. I've talked to Mike extensively about that, and the catchers that put their weight on their left leg when receiving throws from either left center or right field can ward off base runners in that fashion. If you put your leg on, if you put your weight on your right leg, as an example, you can have your left leg in the baseline. But when the runner slides straight in and these guys are going full speed and you're standing still, they can spin that left leg out of there. And that's why it's very important to keep the weight on the left leg. But there are a number of catchers who don't do that. They make swipe tags with that catcher's mitt, and I think it's the wrong way to go about it. And unfortunately, I see more and more of that today, the swipe tags at home plate, instead of guys who just hang in there and take their punishment. An interesting story, back in the early 70s, and I've said that this during the broadcast many times, the Met broadcast, that Tommy Agee actually stuck in my shin guards two different times to give you an idea of the force that a runner has when he comes into a catcher.
And by that you mean his spikes. His spikes were in your shin guard.
His spikes were actually in my shin guards, and to loosen the spikes from the shin guards, I had to take the shin guards off. But that gives you an idea of why a lot of catchers have knee problems and stuff like that, because of, you know, Tommy Agee was a 215-pound, 6'2" with thighs like most players' waists. He was big, he was fast, and that's a perfectly clean play. And interestingly, Tommy Agee told me about 3 years ago that the guy who taught him how to do that was a catcher, John Roseboro of the Dodgers. Catchers shouldn't teach runners how to slide into them.
And that comes from a former catcher, our guest today, Tim McCarver. He's now a baseball analyst. He played in the major leagues for 21 years, and he's just written a book called Tim McCarver's Baseball for Brain Surgeons and Other Fans. Well, let me get to the pitcher-catcher relationship, because as you write about it, it seems that it's the job of the catcher to handle the pitcher and to, I think, as you say, to keep them honest. You're also quoted as saying that the catcher's job is to cut through the crap, which I assume is to keep it to the kind of essence of baseball. You caught for both Steve Carlton and Bob Gibson. How different were they, and how did you handle each of their personalities? And they're very different personalities.
Yeah, very different. Bob Gibson, perhaps the most aggressive, dynamic personality that I've ever run into in my life, on or off the field. Mm-hmm. He was also a very gifted athlete. He played 3 years for the Harlem Globetrotters in his early days while he was still a young pitcher out of Creighton University in Omaha. He was very difficult to handle when I was young. Bob found me very difficult to handle, too, and we clashed. And now I consider Bob Gibson one of my top five friends in life. You become very, very close to the pitchers, but just because you're close friends doesn't mean that that pitchers snapping at catchers or catchers snapping at pitchers doesn't happen all the time. In 1965, it was a 1-1 game in the eighth inning at Old Forbes Field in Pittsburgh. And there were two men on, second and third. We, meaning Bob Gibson, elected to pitch to Roberto Clemente. He hit a fastball on the outside corner, as Clemente could do. He hit it about a 38 hopper through the hole on the right side. Two runners scored, and that made the score 3-1 Pittsburgh. Well, Bob Gibson went to back me up, and as he's going back to the mound, he said, no expletive deleted or anything like this, and no profanity, but there was profanity when he said, "You've got more than one finger back there," which meant that I could call for something other than a fastball.
Right.
And I said, "You've also got a head on your shoulders, and you can shake me off if you like also." And we were arguing to the point where both of us dropped our gloves between home and the pitcher's mound and almost came to blows. And I didn't speak to him until his next start.
Well, let me ask you, too, about the trepidation you used to feel when you had to go out to the mound to talk to Bob Gibson, because he never wanted to hear anything you had
to
say.
No, he didn't. Bob was never intimidated by anybody, by managers, by opposing hitters or anything. Well, I went out to the mound to try and slow him down because I was encouraged to do that by our manager, Johnny Keene. Well, Bob used to like to work very rapidly. Mm-hmm. They called him Rapid Robert, as a matter of fact. Rapid Robert Gibson was called that because he worked so quickly. And sometimes he would actually go into his windup before I put the signs down. Meaning he threw everything for the most part the same speed, but he loved to work fast. Well, I went out to the mound and I said, "Bob, I'm out here to slow you down." He said, "Get on back behind the plate. The only thing that you know about pitching is that it's hard to hit." I didn't like to hear that. Johnny Keene continued to try to encourage me to slow him down. And I told John, "Look, he doesn't want to be slowed down. If you want to slow him down, you slow him down. Don't be telling me to do it."
You also say some interesting things about Steve Carlton and his ability to concentrate, and that when he was pitching, he essentially made the batter disappear, that it was you and he playing this rather sophisticated game of catch.
That was one of Steve's lines before the game. He would say, "Timmy, let's go play some pitch and catch."
Right.
It was almost
forget the batter, right?
Forget the batter. The batter was almost like some alien that had plopped down with a piece of wood in his hands. And the obvious inference there is that if Steve makes his pitch, nobody's going to hit it. But Steve Carlton was ahead of his time as far as his imagery was concerned. He would sit in the clubhouse, and he would visualize the outside 2 inches of the plate and the inside 2 inches of the plate with the theory that if he did that, he would stay away from the middle 13 inches of the plate. And you know what? He didn't throw too many balls down the middle of the plate. The plate's 17 inches wide, but only 4 inches are the pitchers, the outside two and the inside two.
And he said he rarely ever heard the crowd. I know he rarely ever acknowledged
the
crowd.
He wore earplugs.
Right, just to be able to focus that kind of attention to what he had to do, I assume.
Either focus on keeping the crowd out of his ears or me.
I'm curious about something that you write about, which is the catcher trying to influence the umpire and even making comments as the pitcher is pitching the ball, hoping somehow to, put some sort of influence into the umpire's brain. Did you do that a lot?
I think all catchers try to persuade the umpire through body movement, through the movement of the mitt, or through something that could be said while the ball is on the way to the plate. For instance, mm-hmm. if on an 0-2 pitch or a 1-2 pitch, one ball and two strike pitch, you are sitting outside the strike zone, and you know that the pitcher is going to throw to your glove outside the strike zone, say 2 inches off the outside part of the plate. As the ball is on its way, by saying, "Yes, sir," you would perhaps influence an umpire to call the pitch a strike, even though the pitch is 2 inches outside, because primarily the pitcher is hitting your mitt, and the umpire doesn't think that you would set up in an area where the pitch is not a strike, because normally you wouldn't do that. But since you're ahead in the count, you have the luxury of sitting outside the strike zone and perhaps either having the umpire call the ball a strike or having the hitter swing at a ball and perhaps hitting it off the end of the bat and thereby keeping the ball off the fat part of the bat. So there are ways to influence umpires, but most of the umpires know the tricks. I think the younger the umpire, the more influenced he is. The older the catcher, the more he can influence an umpire, which makes all the sense in the world.
As a catcher, can you actually see the ball come in?
Are you kidding? You better be able to see it.
Well, and I guess I know you see it, but I guess see it in all its detail. Or
absolutely, you can see the seams on it. You can see the. Number one, you know the movement of the pitch. You perhaps have caught this pitcher in Gibson's case, in Carlton's case. I caught them 9 or 10 years, and you're talking 35 to 40 starts a year. In those days, there were four-man rotations. So you 35 to 40 starts a year, and in every game, they threw anywhere from 110 to 135 pitches. So you know these pitchers very, very well. You know what their pitches do. Now, obviously, they're not going to do the same thing all the time, but they have tendencies. Bob Gibson's slider was a big slider, for instance. Steve Carlton's slider was a tightly wrapped spin. Bob Gibson's slider coming in with the seams as they rotated was more of a quarter or half dollar spin. That's normally, and what I mean by that is that the seams spun in a loose fashion, And the appearance was that you could fit a quarter in this spinning fashion, or in this, the spin of the baseball because of the seams. And what that meant was it was loosely gripped. Steve Carlton, on the other hand, had a slider whose spin was so tightly wrapped that the spin looked like a dime, that you could fit a dime on the tightly wrapped slider. Now, normally speaking, the dime spin on a slider is the best pitch to throw because it has more movement. But in Gibson's case, his slider was so erratic and unusual that it actually served better for him because of its erratic movement. It would back up occasionally. It would it would break a foot sometimes. When he struck out Willie Horton to end the first game of the 1968 World Series, for example, he set a major league record for strikeouts in a single World Series game, 17.
Wow.
It was a remarkable accomplishment. And Willie Horton, to this day, I can still hear Willie Horton go, He thought the ball had hit him, and the ball was a strike over the middle of the plate. That's how much the ball broke.
We'll talk more with Tim McCarver after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Tim McCarver is our guest, and his book is called Baseball for Brain Surgeons and Other Fans. And he's a baseball analyst for TV and played major leagues for 21 years. You grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. You were one of five children, and it actually was your sister, as I understand it, that really taught you to play baseball. Is that true?
My sister, Marilyn, was perhaps the best athlete in our family. Of the five children, four were boys. I was the next to the last. My sister was the next to the oldest. And all of my brothers were right-handed throwers and hitters. I was a right-handed thrower, but at 4 years old, you don't really realize whether you're going to be a left-handed hitter or a right-handed hitter. And she used to take me and roll ground balls to me from about 10 feet, and I would swing at these ground balls left-handed and became very adept. I never really knew how to hit right-handed because she wanted me to be different. And sure enough, I had an inclination to hit left-handed, and that's why I do everything else right-handed but swing a bat 20 years ago and swing a golf club now.
Do you think she was right to do that at a very
young age?
I thought
she was left to do that.
But did it turn out that that was good advice for you?
No, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think left-handed hitters in baseball have a decided advantage. Mm-hmm. My broadcasting partner, Ralph Kiner, says that the reason left-handers have an advantage is that they're closer to first base. Very simple, really.
Interesting, interesting. Now, you started in the majors right out of high school. How ready were you at the age of 17 to be a professional baseball player? How much did you know about the world? You laugh.
I
guess not much, right?
The farthest west I'd ever been was West Memphis.
Truly.
And I'm saying that seriously. I didn't travel that much as a kid. Didn't have the money to travel anywhere. But I was as green could be. 9 days after I graduated from high school, I started my career in Keokuk, Iowa. And later that year, I was to go to Rochester, and I joined the major league club, the St. Louis Cardinals, in Milwaukee. And I couldn't talk real well until I was about 7 years old. I was tongue-tied, as we used to call it. And I could not pronounce my S's. I would for my S's. S's came out as a T-H. I was a huge baseball fan because of my sister, and we used to listen to Harry Carey of the Cardinals in Memphis, only 290 miles away. And the name that was easy for me to pronounce was Hank Aaron. I guess if I had an idol, Monty Irvin and Hank Aaron. They were easy for me to pronounce, so I came up thinking that Hank Aaron and Monty Irvin were my favorite players, and without knowing their credentials. Well, as I was sitting on the bench in Milwaukee for my first game in a gray Cardinal uniform, Aaron came up, and I yelled, "Come on, Henry." Well, obviously, I'm a St. Louis Cardinal, a member of the St. Louis Cardinals, and Alex Grammas came over. He was a shortstop of the Cardinals in those days, and he said, "Up here, son, we root for our own teammates, not for the other guys." It was very embarrassing, but I was very green. I spent parts of 1959, 60, and 61 with the big team. And then in 1963, I was with the Cardinals to stay for a number of years.
Were there initiations or hazing for you or things to get you into adulthood, I guess?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I did not have a part in my hair till I was 23 years old. I wore a crew cut. And I think my first... my first road trip as a major league player, I had on wingtips, brown wingtips, yellow socks, gray slacks, this off kind of an orange-red Banlon shirt that was in style in those days, and a plaid sport coat.
Oh, I bet you thought you looked just great,
too.
Oh,
I was styling, let me tell you. And Bob Niemann, who was an outfielder, called me Bush. And for about 2 years, that name hung with me, and Bush is obviously the connotation of that, is that you're a Bush leaguer, which was a denigrating term, but I didn't realize the significance of the term because I was too green to understand, and it was all done in fun, and not only did I allow it, but I was kind of proud of that name.
Well, final question to you. What's your favorite time in a ballpark?
During the game, when the game's going on. I love the game. I love the nuances of the game. I love to watch the things that are away from the ball. I think one of the great exercises that fans could enjoy at a baseball game is, like, you may zero in on an interior lineman in football, a pulling guard, for instance, instead of the guy with the ball, is to divert your attention away from the ball and look what the center fielder is doing. When he's playing the count, for instance, by that I mean if the batter is ahead in the count, the center fielder would play him more to pull. If the batter is behind in the count because he's in a defensive posture, he would play more to hit the ball the other way. Andy Van Slyke was particularly adept at that particular defensive positioning. Things of that nature, that's the beauty of the game. There's so much to the game than just home runs,
sure,
and shutouts and no-hitters. Those are the glamour parts of the game, sure, and I love those. But the game has so many other nuances that make baseball such an enjoyable sport that I could obviously go on and on and on. And that's why it's been such a part of my life for 39 years.
Sure. Well, I appreciate you going on and on with us today on the show. Thank you very much, Tim McCarver.
I enjoyed it, Marty. Thank you.
Baseball analyst Tim McCarver. His book is Baseball for Brain Surgeons and Other Fans. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we feature an interview with Jamie Lee Curtis. The horror classic Halloween launched her acting career. Now she stars in the 20th anniversary sequel, Halloween H2O. Linguist Jeff Numberg comments on the latest management buzzword, and rock historian Ed Ward tells us the strange story of singer Joe Tex. His life was a tangle of contradictions.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Few tales in soul music are as odd as that of Joe Tex, a black man with a lifelong desire to enter the world of country music, one of the few soul artists to be based in Nashville, a preacher who renounced Christianity, and a lifelong teetotaler who died from alcohol and drug abuse. He would have been 65 tomorrow. Rock historian Ed Ward says Joe Tex remains a mystery even now.
I don't have a love that I have been used to. I don't have anyone to say, Joe, I miss you. So if it's true that you're blue, 'cause the same thing has happened to you, don't hesitate, don't make me wait, meet me in church. You see, my love affair.
Joe Tex had been kicking around for a long time before he got his first hit. He'd been born Joseph Arrington Jr. in 1933, or maybe 1935, in Baytown, Texas. And after the usual experiences in church and talent shows, he was discovered by singer Arthur Prysock in a club on Long Island. And Prysock took him to Henry Glover at King Records, who was so impressed he signed him on the spot. The early records he made there, though, showed a lack of direction. Sometimes he sounded like Little Richard, sometimes like Fats Domino, and always, in the back of his mind, he wanted to be a country singer. He claimed, and it can't be proven, that he wrote the immense hit Fever for Little Willie John, a song turned into a million seller by Peggy Lee, based on the chords of Tennessee Ernie Ford's 16 Tons, and sold the song to Glover for a month's rent. Flushed with success, as he saw it, he headed to Nashville, bought a purple cowboy outfit, and hung around the backstage of the Grand Ole Opry, hoping to be discovered. This is where Buddy Killen, a successful country producer, first saw him, but it was a while before they actually met. Meanwhile, Tex headed to New Orleans, then back to Nashville, writing songs for Jerry Butler and James Brown, who was dating his ex-wife. In 1960, someone recommended he go and see Killen, who was working at Tree Music, one of Nashville's biggest publishers, and Killen realized he had a major talent in front of him. Since no one wanted to sign him, Killen and a partner started Dial Records, and for 4 years managed a few local successes. By 1964, though, he was about to give up when, at a session in Muscle Shoals, they took a song Tex had thrown together and hated and, out of dozens of versions, spliced together something to release.
You had the better hold on. Hold on to what you before you can count. One, two, three. Yes, they will. Yes, they will. Listen, fellas, you know it's not...
Atlantic Records snapped it up, and Hold What You've Got launched Joe Tex's career. He was a tricky songwriter, playing with the lengths of lines and delivering songs with strong moral messages. In 1969, at the height of his success, Joe had a religious awakening when he heard some preachers from the Nation of Islam. Although he couldn't line up their idea with the white man as the devil with his own life experience, he retired to his farm, took the name Yusuf Haziz, and spent some time preaching his own brand of Islam. But in 1972, he called Killin' again, and the next record they did was the biggest of his career.
Well, I gotcha! Uh-huh, you thought I didn't see you now, didn't you? You tried to sneak by me now, didn't you? Now give me what you promised me. Give it, yeah, come on!
He toured and recorded erratically, and in 1977 had one last hit.
Three nights ago, I was at a disco. Man, I wanted to bump. I was praying to go. And this big fat woman bumped me on the floor. She was praying to go. That chick was praying to go. Man, she did a dip. Almost broke my hip. She was getting down. That chick was getting down. She wanted to bump.
Ain't Gonna Bump No More With No Big Fat Woman was his swan song. In 1979, for reasons no one can explain, not even Buddy Killin, who knew him as well as anyone, this man, who had never touched drugs or alcohol in his life, went on a 5-year bender and suffered a heart attack in August 1982, which killed him several days later. Joe Tex is an enigma, but one who embodies a lot of the contradictions of American music. He may have wanted to be country, but he left behind a legacy of some of the greatest soul music ever.
Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin. This is Fresh Air. Twenty years ago, Jamie Lee Curtis started her career as the Queen of Scream in John Carpenter's Halloween. She played 17-year-old Laurie Strode, the intended victim of her masked brother, Michael Myers. Curtis followed up with roles in other slasher films like Terror Train, Prom Night, and Halloween 2, and some people wondered if Jamie Lee Curtis would ever break out of horror films. But the comedies Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda took care of that. Now Curtis is returning to her horror roots in the latest sequel to Halloween, Halloween H2O. She's reprising her role as Laurie Strode, who has assumed a new identity and works as headmistress of a private high school. Let's listen to a scene in which Laurie tells her lover, played by Adam Arkin, about her past.
My brother killed my sister when she was 17.
How'd he do that?
With a really big, sharp kitchen knife.
It's terrible. Take off your gloves.
You said you'd listen.
Okay.
It happened on Halloween. You've heard the story.
Who hasn't? Michael Myers. It's like 20 years ago, right?
1978.
What happened to the sister? She died, right?
No, she faked her death. Hoping and praying every year that her brother won't find her.
You're telling me the truth?
Now, do you want a drink?
Yeah.
Among the stars of Halloween H2O is Janet Leigh, Jamie Lee Curtis's mother, who's best known as the victim killed in the shower in Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. Her father is actor Tony Curtis. Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh separated when Jamie was 3, and she grew up with her mother. Terry Gross spoke with Jamie Lee Curtis in 1990 and asked her about her Hollywood upbringing.
You've described your childhood, growing up in the Hollywood area, as growing up with royalty. How would you compare the kind of Hollywood experience with, growing up with your mother, Janet Leigh, who was a Hollywood star? How did that compare to royalty?
First of all, any recollection or point that I make about my childhood, is always made from a retrospective position. It's being made as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
As an adult, I look back on my childhood and imagine that when you have famous parents, particularly Hollywood celebrities who are risen above a status, because they're bigger than life on the movie screen, they were both beautifully, physically beautiful people, very talented, and the public loved them so. There is a royal sense. I remember going to Disneyland and having one of those VIP tours. I never had to stand in a line. It was just that part of my life. It was when I was a child, I didn't remember this. It wasn't like as a child I thought I was a little princess. And as a child, I was a normal kid. I had a great time. And my mother, she wasn't like walking around. I'm saying that the perception of my parents was that they were. My mother raised us in a rural area of Los Angeles, almost a countrified atmosphere, up a dirt road with a donkey outside our house. In a corral. I mean, we lived in the country. We were raised a very natural existence in California, but certainly not a glitzy, glamo one, which is not something my mother adopted as a personal lifestyle at all.
Did the studios do any publicity around your birth? And if so, I was wondering if you read the articles or saw news clips when you were older.
Well, certainly now, in retrospect, I have many of these funny old Life magazines and photo plays. People have told me all my life, I remember when you were born. And it's not something that I walk around going, a lot of people know when I was born. it's hard to talk about this because I really want to impart that this is not something that I think about. It's not something that I apply to my life or my daily life ever. It is a fact that this happened. And yes, my parents were huge stars at the time, and my birth was a big deal to a lot of people.
Were there any fantasies that were made up about your family at around the time of your birth? I mean, looking back, can you separate fact from fiction? The Hollywood publicity offices were really famous for just constructing lives that would be glamorous, for making things up about their star.
I read these things, and I don't believe that one word is attributed directly to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was made up. I think every single word was made up. Or they would take the fact of that Janet and Tony were married and they had a baby and, our life is blessed by our baby Kelly or, I truly believe that it was just manipulated. It was just that sort of manipulation of what people wanted to hear.
I know when I was growing up, I had so many fantasies that were based on movies that I'd seen. And I'm thinking that when
tell us a few, we want to know.
Never, never.
We here in America want to know.
But I'm thinking when you were growing up,
Tyrone Power in a pair of jodhpurs anything to do with those?
But your parents were in the movies, and unlike my parents, and all of their friends were the movie stars. So I was wondering if the movies were they a part of your fantasy life, or did they just seem like what the parents do when they go to work?
No, unfortunately, one of my saddest feelings about being raised in Hollywood, if there really is something that I consciously, as an adult, look back on and think I wish I could have changed it, because I saw and knew movies, the magic is broken for me. And I was never, as a child, like I'm sure so many people who are not from the movie industry, are enamored by films and have a really romantic, powerful relationship with going to movies. Many people talk about, particularly filmmakers and actors, talk about all their lives going to the cinema, all their lives being taken to movies and watching. And I just didn't have that. Although I was shown films, they did not impart a magical quality to me. It was more just a very sort of cutthroat, this is the movie, but da-da-da-da-da. And I wish I had that sort of magical dream of being in the movies that people sit back in that dark theater and think, I'll be up there someday. I didn't have that fantasy.
Since, you know, growing up in Hollywood, movies were so work-related to you, when did you decide you wanted to act yourself?
Well, again, growing up in Hollywood, you know, they were work-related in the sense that my mom and dad did them, and I would go and hang out on the set on occasion. You know, I was in school most of the time, so you don't go hang out very much. And again, I don't have any recollection of when it was I decided to do it. It just was, you know, really by chance that it happened that I'm an actress today, because a tennis teacher I knew was sort of turned into a quasi-manager, and he wanted me to go up for Nancy Drew, which I didn't get, but I guess there was interest in who this girl, new girl, little girl was. I was in college at the time and ended up in California on a month's break and did an independent study on just sort of how to break into show business. And I ended up signing a contract with Universal Studios for right at the end of that month, right before I was supposed to go back to college, and never went back.
This is Universal TV?
Well, at the time it was Universal. Well, I mean, it was MCA Universal. They were the last studio to still have a contract system, very much like my parents. I mean, the ironic thing that, in fact, nobody's brought up very much, and I find interesting, is that both of my parents were contract players when they first started acting. They were young people. My mother was discovered, literally discovered. My father was in New York. He was discovered, brought out to Hollywood. Both of them grew up on the studio system. And in fact, I was one of the last actresses in the world to be under contract. Literally 7-year, 6-month option, their option contract, where I got paid $235 a week. And they disbanded the contract system about 3 years into my contract. But I did. They farmed me out to do Halloween. They lent me out. I mean, it was a real contract system. Sharon Gless, mm-hmm. myself, Delta Burke was under contract at some point. Andrew Stevens.
Were you groomed to be a certain kind of actress by Universal? Because you know, in the contract system, you were often groomed to be a certain type for certain types of roles.
No, one of the reasons I think the contract system disbanded was at one point Universal had like a monopoly on primetime television. And so it was very convenient for them to have sort of a crop of young actors that they could still had to audition for parts, but they were paying them a fairly small amount of money and giving them experience. And the hope of the contract system always is that you're going to groom a young star, that one of these times you give this person a part, it becomes huge, you've got this person under contract for no money, and you basically have a very hot commodity which you're not paying a lot of money to and you're making a lot of money on. The problem with the current contract system that finally disbanded was that they never took it that final step. They never had the material or the bravery to sort of give one of these contract actors the big break. They just never had the guts to go with a contract actor. They always went with like some other person from the outside. And so they really disbanded it. Whereas in my parents' generation, you know, they did, and they also, in my parents' generation, there were acting teachers afforded to these contract players. They taught you how to dress and makeup, and they groomed you in as either a, you know, the fresh country girl or the femme fatale or whatever. There was no support given to these contract actors except a paycheck every week and the knowledge that they would get a good shot at getting some episodic television. That was it. So I think another reason it disbanded is it just wasn't, in a modern society, it's just not feasible to have that.
So what did you get? What kind of roles did you get in the 3 years that you had this contract?
Well, I did two lines on Quincy was my first job. Then I did an emergency. Then I played a biker chick on Nancy Drew. Then I did one other show there, and I can't remember what it was. And then I did the pilot for a series at Universal called Operation Petticoat, which during the shooting of the pilot, it was a 2-hour movie of the week that was a backdoor pilot is what they call it. And in the middle of shooting that 2-hour movie of the week, we got picked up as a series. So all of a sudden, I was on a series for a year, Operation Petticoat, 1978.
So Universal Studio loaned you out to do Halloween. How did you get the part of Halloween? It was your first movie, wasn't it? Starring role in a movie, anyways.
Oh, certainly. It was an audition. Like, you know, when you're a young actor, you audition every day. And it was just another audition. I just went in and read for John Carpenter and then came back and read again and then came back and read again and got the part.
I know Halloween was considered the first in the slasher films and everything, but really you were the kind of heroine in it who was important because You weren't the passive victim. You were being stalked by the psychotic killer, and you were fighting back, and you won. And that was kind of a breakthrough in a lot of ways, really. Were you aware of that at the time?
I was aware that I was very glad that I was upholding the strength of women. I also was playing women with intelligence. Mm-hmm. I was playing the high school brain. I was playing what we all hope are the good virtues of young women, you know, women who are intelligent, who read, who study, who are good friends. I mean, I really believed, even though I was being slammed up against the wall by the women's groups, that I was in these what seemed to be exploitation films. I was not being exploited. I felt I was upholding very, you know, I mean, in the context of real life, we're talking about a horror movie. But in it, since it was my only job and I was a young woman, I felt I was holding up the real, you know, the best that I could be as a woman in those films. I certainly was never playing the slut or the little tease or any of those that would be easily exploitable parts. I was playing the good girls, and I was very happy to have that role.
Jamie Lee Curtis stars in the new film Halloween H2O. She spoke with Terry back in 1990. This is Fresh Air. For the past 20 or 30 years, we've been hearing about nothing but the information age. Now the rage in business is all about knowledge, knowledge management, knowledge workers, knowledge sharing, and the like. According to our linguist, Jeff Numberg, it all goes back to T.S. Eliot.
In a sense, the knowledge management craze originated with T.S. Eliot's famous lines from The Rock. Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? But of course, Eliot's sententious pessimism is a little out of step for modern technocrats. It was left to Al Gore to give it the upbeat turn it needed in a speech he first gave around 1990. Gore took Eliot's wisdom, knowledge, and information, threw in a couple of other terms like data and understanding, and arranged them in a golden chain of added value. Our challenge is to process data into information, refine information into knowledge, extract from knowledge understanding, and then let understanding ferment into wisdom. This was a vision that technologists and managers could love, with humanity progressing up the ladder rather than down it. But actually, the rungs have been coming together for the last couple of decades. That data into information business first caught on in the 70s as a way of talking about the added value of systems like graphical user interfaces and automatic spreadsheets, which promise to make data more comprehensible. It's true the definition of information as processed data has no real scientific basis. The information that computers traffic in is just the meaningless stuff of ones and zeros and has nothing to do with the sort of meaningful content that we have in mind when we talk about the information economy and the like. But it was a compelling rhetorical turn which helped to sell a lot of software. And in fact, the definition has even managed to work its way into some dictionaries, which I suppose makes it true. The only problem with all this was that the information technology that organizations were deploying didn't seem to produce any dramatic productivity gains. One popular theory about this failure was that information by itself wasn't enough to turn the trick. It just piled up in individual cubicles where nobody knew how to find it or how to make it useful. That was what led the management gurus to grab onto the next rung of the ladder and establish the new cult of knowledge. You can understand why this would be an appealing move. It's like the difference between medical information and medical knowledge. With the first, you think of a collection of facts and figures. With the second, you think of a community that can put the information to use. Out of that eminently reasonable hypothesis grew the knowledge craze. When it comes to being slaves to fashion, American managers make adolescent girls look like rugged individualists. And before long, the boardrooms and business journals were buzzing with phrases like knowledge assets, knowledge ecology, knowledge creation, and knowledge sharing. The vendors of everything from email to web search tools are billing their products as knowledge management systems. More than 100 companies in the Fortune 500 have established a post of chief knowledge officer, and at Berkeley, they even established a distinguished professorship in knowledge. As it happens, it's in the business school, but I guess that chair could have gone to any department. Now, it's true there are real problems that these people are working on, and a lot of these schemes and systems will lead to real productivity gains. But it isn't clear how much the word knowledge will contribute to this. You have this sense it's become a mantra that people chant hopefully over their shrink wrap and reorganization charts. Before long, the word knowledge will wind up on the dust heap of history, alongside of the linguistic detritus of past vogues, words like quality, empowerment, and corporate culture. The management gurus are a restless lot who treat the English vocabulary as an inexhaustible resource. They go through it like Brazilian farmers burning their way through the Amazon forest. And there's no shortage of new words to appropriate as they work their way up the value-added ladder. The other day, I read an interview with a sociologist who was saying that contemporary wisdom research is in its infancy, and I could picture the gleam in her eye. It struck me that this might be a good place to get in on the ground floor. I don't see myself carving out a second career in wisdomology, but maybe it wasn't too late to register some of the web domain names that people are sure to start looking for in a couple of years. But as with most of my million-dollar schemes, I was already well behind the curve. It turned out that the domain wisdom.com has already been grabbed by a Louisiana outfit that sells web products, and understanding.com is registered to a company that puts together software tutorials. In desperation, I even tried enlightenment.com, but it was taken by somebody else. I'd love to tell you what they do, but when I went searching for enlightenment, the server wasn't responding.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Danny Miller is our executive producer. Our engineers this week are Chris Fraley, Bob Purdick, Fred Snyder, and Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.